6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision
fly. And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinor. Happy May Day. Happy International Workers' Day. Things haven't been very good for workers around the world, but we'll continue struggling. Also, got the headphones on me a little too late, so I'm not sure I heard correctly, but it seems like the Attorney General or the DA, whatever she is in, Baltimore is going to charge the cops who killed Mr. Gray, if that is so, about time. Anyway, very full show today. The second half hour, we'll be talking to Professor Noam Chomsky. We will talk about Baltimore and the Middle East and the Mediterranean, hopefully. But we are starting with a discussion again about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, known as the TPP, which might become a reality soon, and we would like to keep informing you of what that means. On the phone with us are Patrick Woodall. He's the research director and senior policy advocate for Food and Water Watch. And thank you, Patrick, for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yep. And also with us is Sean Flynn, associate director of the Program on Information, Justice and Intellectual Property at the Washington College of Law at American University. And thank you, Sean, for joining us, too.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And let's start with you, Patrick, if you can very briefly let those of our listeners who may not know yet what the TPP is, what the implications might be, if you can just explain what that is very briefly.
Sure. The TPP is a 12-nation trade deal with countries around the Pacific Ocean. It is basically an expansion of the worst elements of the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's going to have a huge impact on workers. You know, we've lost thousands of jobs, and in Wisconsin's lost 83,000 jobs because of NAFTA and the China trade deal alone, according to the Economic Policy Institute. And, you know, it has effects on our standard of living, the quality of our food, and the regulations that govern food safety and consumer protection.
Mm-hmm. And Sean, what are your specific concerns to do with the TPP?
Well, I think you're going to hear a lot of common ground between Patrick and I today. I mean, I think one of the issues that both of us are really focused on is the so-called ISDS, or Investor State Dispute Settlement Clause. This is often the most controversial part of free trade agreements, which allows private corporations to challenge the regulations from democratically elected officials, but it does so in a court process that is foreign, is not subject to the U.S. Constitution, and that is often secret, even revealing secret judgments in the end. And with me specifically, I'm an intellectual property professor, and there's been a recent slew of cases that have used this kind of a process to challenge intellectual property limitations and exceptions. So that concerns IP academics and a really broad sector of the population around the world.
Mm-hmm. So let's continue with that for another question. Why should your average citizen be concerned about these issues of intellectual ownership?
Well, so the IP issue, so what we're finding just recently, you know, two big cases I think illustrate what's going on. So one is a pharmaceutical company who has challenged in Canada, a ruling in Canada denying extensions of patents on medicines that were originally developed in the 1970s. So patents on medicines gives you a monopoly to be the only supplier, so it essentially determines how much your medicines are going to cost. Patented medicines cost more. And the longer we extend patents, the more medicines will cost over a longer period of time. And so some patents on some old medicines were rejected in Canada, and the the company Eli Lilly has sued Canada in these ISDS investor state dispute settlement procedures under NAFTA in order to elongate those patents. So that's a kind of decision that could have effect. And in another case, the cigarette company Philip Morris have challenged regulations of advertising on the coverages of cigarettes. Similar cases have been brought in the U.S. under the First Amendment. Here they've been brought under the regulatory takings provisions of free trade agreements, of investment state settlement agreements that are very much like the TPP. So those are certain ways these intellectual property arguments are being used to essentially turn over, you know, what Patrick adequately defined as health and safety regulations.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, I started by noting that this is May Day, internationally known as Workers' Day. How would the TPP affect the rights of workers, and specifically workers in the United States?
Well, our experience with the trade deals to date have been should be a stark warning for the TPP. So under NAFTA and our trade deal with China and other free trade agreements, factories here have shut down. They've moved overseas where wages are maybe lower, where worker protections are non-existent, where independent unions may not exist, and where environmental regulations are weaker and unenforced to save money. And what this has meant is that we've lost a lot of very valuable middle-class jobs that support families. And that has contributed to a kind of broad-based growing wealth and income inequality in America. So there's almost total agreement amongst academic experts that globalization and these free trade deals have significantly contributed to the growing gap between the wealthy and the haves and the have-nots in America. So those kind of issues are very, very serious, and employers have used them, the trade deals, to crack unions. They threaten to move their plants overseas, and this tends to push down on wages and on benefits and reduces the number of good manufacturing jobs in America. Remember, some of the partners in the TPP are countries with fairly appalling labor conditions. We're talking about countries like Vietnam that have where forced labor is not uncommon, where there are no independent unions, where the wages are pennies, and countries like Malaysia, which also have problems with independent labor unions and are a country where the Labor Department, the State Department, views as one of the worst on human trafficking. So these are very serious issues. It's very hard for workers in America with safeguards to protect their health and safety at the job, where they negotiate for benefits, to compete with potentially kids working in sweatshop factories halfway across the world.
Mm-hmm. So all these things that you have said now were raised by some Democratic lawmakers who are objecting to the TPP, and in response, President Obama has said, "That is nonsense. I have been on the side of American workers all along, and of course I continue to be, and this will be good to American workers." What do you think about that?
Well, that's the exact same line of argument that President Clinton used when he pushed NAFTA. He said that he was doing it because he believed it would create jobs, and possibly President Obama believes that as well. But the real-life experience of these trade deals over the past 25 years has been one that shows that they tend to lower employment, to reduce wages, to reduce benefits, to lower union density. And so those things are facts. They have occurred, and they have tended to get worse over time. So whether the president actually believes this or not, I suppose, is open to some speculation. But the reality is that these trade deals, like the TPP, are going to hurt workers in America. And remember, the people that are going to get these jobs are people that are going to be under the boot heel of some employer in a sweatshop in the developing world. So it's not great for labor conditions in Vietnam or Malaysia either.
Mm-hmm. Sean, how do you understand Obama's desire to pass this and the fact that he has gotten the fast track to go about it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a divide in the politics. I'm not really a political science professor. You know, I think that from the perspective of the United States Trade Representative, which is really the one advising him most closely, they see this agreement as ultimately benefiting U.S. corporations. I think that, you know, particularly in the intellectual property area, that is seen as the area where the United States Trade Representative thinks that they're trying to get something. But it's important that we have to, you know, realize who are the industries that they're trying to get something for. So essentially they're trying to get something for large multinational pharmaceutical industries. And that would be by locking in the most draconian aspects of our patent law so that Congress can't change it later over time, and extending those same kind of policies to other countries. And then the other would be essentially the Hollywood content movie industries, which are trying to lock down piracy on the internet all around the world. So this is where, you know, the very controversial laws like the SOPA PIPA legislation and the last big international trade agreement, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which was met on the streets of Europe by hundreds of thousands of people and ultimately never went to Congress. So these industries want very controversial things. They want higher drug prices. They want more regulation of what some people consider freedom of speech on the internet. And ultimately, they see that as benefiting U.S. corporations. But it's important to notice, you know, which segments of the industry they're benefiting and how.
Mm-hmm. And Patrick, that would also benefit much of the mass food production industries, won't it? And how?
Well, I think Sean makes a great case, which is that the purpose of these deals is to give these companies a venue where they can pursue their most aggressive deregulation agendas outside of the view of the U.S. public. They are using trade deals to circumvent the Congress and to circumvent the U.S. regulatory process so they can get more lucrative things from them. So we're concerned on the food safety side that this trade deal will provide a forum for countries to challenge U.S. food safety laws, potentially weaken U.S. food safety standards. And the goal for them is to accelerate the commercial flow of food across the border. So what they want, and they've said this in letters to the Congress, that they want to be able to bring food across the border more quickly and to reduce the kind of inspection that we have at the border. And so for them, the most important part is to bring the food here more quickly, but it's being produced in places that have potentially weaker standards, potentially weaker oversight, and then imported to the U.S., where we already have a great difficulty inspecting the imports that we bring in, and now this will increase the volume of imports, and the goal is to have a more rigorous trade disciplines over U.S. food safety standards and U.S. inspection.
Mm-hmm. We do have a caller. Let's get to that person right away. Hi, Mike. What, you're on air.
I'm concerned about the greenhouse gases and global warming, climate change issues, and I was wondering how much additional oil would be burned as a result of the TPP compared to what is done under the existing trade agreements, because this is going to be increasing trade, right? With China and Japan and all these countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Patrick, I think that question is for you.
Sure. I think, obviously, the increased commercial traffic is going to be a lot of more cargo ships. So there'll be cargo ships coming from the Pacific across the ocean. So that's more fossil fuel burning in the air. And the other issue on this, people should understand that although environmental advocates have pushed to ensure that there would be stronger environmental provisions in the agreement, there really are not. They're not very binding. They really focused on conservation measures. And the issue of climate change is one that the administration refuses to deal with in this trade deal. And for us, the issue is also related to fracking, because the process of fracking for natural gas which is can pollute the water and the air and contributes to climate change, under free trade agreements, we can automatically export natural gas to free trade agreement partners, which would accelerate the amount of natural gas sales to places like Japan, which is a TPP nation, and it imports a tremendous amount of the global trade in natural gas, which will accelerate fracking here in the U.S. and cause the co-committant amount of greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm. And Sean, we have learned about the whole intellectual property limitations and exceptions from a leak by WikiLeaks, which raises the question of why is it that this is done, these discussions have been done in secret, lawmakers themselves have not been participating in it, most of them. They have said that they don't know much about it. That doesn't seem very democratic, and of course, everything that we hear about the TPP seems to suggest that the democratic rights that we have will be limited by that. Am I correct? And how much of a concern is it to you?
That is such an important point in this whole conversation, which is that the TPP is the latest in a long line of incredibly secretive agreements, but it is the most secretive one. So we actually only know because of a leak that the rule governing this negotiation requires that all of the United States proposals on behalf of the United States to create new international norms binding U.S. law, that all of those proposals in this negotiation will have to be kept secret until 4 years after the text is finalized and ratified. So that there won't even be a legislative history of this secretive process. The reason for the secrecy is, of course, that the contents of the agreement are incredibly controversial. So, I've signed several letters from law professors analyzing various terms of the leaked agreements and pointing out that these norms are incredibly controversial, even just within the legal academy, both from constitutional law professors that are concerned about the operation of secret courts, which are what these investor cases really are. They're courts that don't have to be open to observation. They can even render judgments that are not published. So there are unpublished judgments coming out of these secret courts on such an incredibly important public matter as the legality of our own regulations and laws under the international system. So it's incredibly controversial. And so the response to that has been to try to hide the content in order to permit them to get these things done without too much public scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. So how do we respond to that? What do you suggest people do?
Well, right now, and Patrick is actually an advocate, so he should probably answer to some of this, but right now,
we will ask
Congress
him to.
Is actually considering a bill, a fast-track bill, to approve the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement before it is publicly released. So Congress will give up its ability to review the agreement before they see the agreement is the proposal from the Obama administration. It's pushing right now. It was going to be up for a vote this week. It may come up for a vote next week, but the reason it's being delayed is because it's becoming more controversial. So engaging the political system and calling your representative is really one of the key asks at this point in the public debate.
Yes, and Patrick, in the last 3 minutes or so that we have, maybe you can touch also on concerns like GMO labeling and the future of local sovereignty and whether all our organic farmers and such would even be able to continue farming, how it will affect us, the consumers, and what should people do? And sorry, we have very little time.
Well, Sean is right. People need to call their member of Congress and urge them to oppose the fast-track legislation that is actually being sponsored by Wisconsin's own Paul Ryan with support from Ron Kind, both of whom voted for it in the committee. This is the moment of truth. We need to block fast-track so that these manifest problems with the deal can be addressed by the Congress. And so this is the key part. I think the question that you asked about the president saying that he was had our best interests at heart
yes.
really goes to this secrecy issue, because if this deal is such a fine one for the American people, then the president should share the terms of the deal with the public so we can make up our own mind about it. But it's hard for us to believe that a deal that is essentially just the worst elements of NAFTA expanded, a NAFTA on steroids, and we're supposed to take that at face value without seeing the terms of it, is extremely undemocratic. We know that it'll threaten our laws protecting consumers, food safety, public health, intellectual property, a host of other issues. It'll threaten our workers. So it's something that needs to be rejected by the Congress. So people need to call and tell their members to vote no on Fast Track.
Mm-hmm. Well, Patrick Woodall, Research Director and Senior Policy Advocate for Food and Water Watch, and Sean Flynn, Associate Director of the Program on Information, Justice, and Intellectual Property at the Washington College of Law at American University. Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, and do, folks, please call your legislators and let them know your opinion. In a, we'll hear some music in a moment. We'll be back with Noam Chomsky. Let's hear some music and be back with Noam Chomsky.
Democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population have to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
It's time to talk about censorship.
This song to 20 people.
But isn't it stealing?
That's your name. Don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
How about trying this future on for size?
It's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
It's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We do what we want to do, you know. They consider that selling out, then whatever. Whatever. Whatever.
Who run Napster should be in prison.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
But isn't it stealing?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
And that was Professor Noam Chomsky with a band whose name I don't have, but hopefully Norm will bring it to me before the end of the hour so I can give them credit. And Professor Noam Chomsky, MIT professor, public intellectual, world-known dissident intellectual, is with us again. Thank you so very much, Noam Chomsky, for making the time to join us again. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be with you again.
And delightful, delightful to have you with us. So if I heard correctly, the DA in Baltimore has decided to bring charges against the police officers who killed a black man in that city. This, of course, has been happening very publicly in many places, including Madison, where recently, again, a white cop killed a young black man unarmed, as were the rest of them. in a sense, there's nothing new about it, but in a sense, things do seem to be somewhat new in the way people are organizing locally, and we may see some change, hopefully, in the way police work. What is your view of what we're seeing right now in the way of race and the killings of mostly black men by white police?
Well, as you say, there's nothing new about it. What happens to be happening right now is a kind of a clustering of events that usually are scattered enough so that they kind of pass under the radar. The clustering probably doesn't mean anything. It's probably just a statistical fluke. But it does, when these things, you know, happen kind of in a brief space of time and in sequence, it does focus attention. The problem, however, is, you know, it's just there all the time. And the problem goes back 400 years. We have never begun to come to terms with slavery and its aftermath. It's worth remembering the basic facts without going into detail. The first slaves arrived about 400 years ago, Massachusetts, Virginia. And if you look over the period since 400 years, there have been a few decades, literally, in which descendants of the slave population, African Americans, have had a sort of a minimal access to the mainstream society up until 1860, you know, till the Civil War. Slavery, of course, was rampant, and slavery in the United States, slavery had existed, you know, forever, but slavery in the United States, comparative studies show, was probably the most extreme and brutal in history. The slave labor camps would have were run with such brutality and viciousness that the Nazis would have appreciated them. Recent scholarship has brought out, especially Edward Baptiste's very important book, has brought out facts about these slave labor camps that had been maybe partially known to mainstream scholarship, but certainly weren't understood, including the extent, first of all, the horrors of the treatment of the slaves. Productivity actually increased very rapidly. Not because of new technology, but just because of increased and more severe torture, which is an indication of the nature of the camps. The cotton, you know, rate of picking cotton, say. The other phenomenon that is underappreciated is that our economy, including the financial system, the commercial system, the manufacturing system, and incidentally Britain's as well, depended very heavily on the high level of production through torture in the slave labor camps. That's a major factor in our wealth and privilege. That goes up to the Civil War. Then comes roughly a decade of relative freedom. Then comes post-Reconstruction policy, which essentially reinstituted a form of slavery, except that it was carried out by the state. Black life was criminalized. A black man could get arrested for standing on a street corner, guilty of vagrancy and so on, couldn't pay the fines, stay there forever. Pretty soon it turned out that a large proportion of the black, especially black male population, was in jail and were being used as a slave labor force. A large part of, we're familiar with the chain gangs, you know, they were kind of visible, agricultural production, but it was mining, manufacturing, a good part of the later American Industrial Revolution of the late 19th, early 20th century was based on slave labor, which from the point of view of the manufacturers and financial institutions, this was great. You had slaves provided for you by the state. You didn't even have to maintain them. That went on virtually to the Second World War, when there was a need for what's called free labor for wartime manufacture. And then come a couple of decades of rapid economic growth, in which African Americans did have a limited chance to enter the mainstream society. There was also during those years some breakdown in the horrendous racist laws and practices, not complete, but at least significant. It kind of ended by the time that the economy began to reverse, late 70s, early 80s. We enter into the neoliberal period in which, of course, there is economic growth, but the economic growth is directed into a very small number of pockets. That's when we begin to get the extreme inequality we have now. So for much of the population, probably majority, real wages almost stagnated, sometimes declined. And while wealth increased, of course, it was very concentrated increasingly in sectors of the economy that are literally predatory, like financial institutions. Long story there. The minimum wage stopped tracking productivity as it had before, and remained essentially flat. If the minimum wage had continued to track productivity, it would probably be double what it is now, even beyond the $15 that people are now struggling for. One effect of all of this was to eliminate, to turn poor industrial workers into a kind of superfluous population. Now, they happen to be here it begins to integrate with race and class, begin to interact. It happens to be heavily black African Americans, and what do you do with them? Well, then comes along the Reagan's race war, called the drug war, which was designed in strictly racist terms, from police work on the streets, way through sentencing and post prison treatment of people targeted by the drug war. And it's essentially rebuilt something like the post-Reconstruction system. Michelle Alexander's important book, The New Jim Crow, describes this. Incidentally, it's a very good book about the post-Reconstruction system. It's Donald Blackman's book, Slavery by Another Name. You put these three books together, Baptiste, Blackman, Alexander, and the story that they tell, what you get is what I started with at the beginning. There have been a couple of decades and 400 years when the African-American population had some sort of a chance to enter into mainstream society. And we see that today. That's what you're seeing in Baltimore and Detroit, and Chicago, everywhere, New York, wherever these murders are taking place. It's a reflection of the fact that that we have never dealt with the legacy of slavery and the impact of it, the aftermath of it for the victims, the slaves and their, you know, their descendants, and you know, everyone associated with them. It's a huge crime, and it's now become a part of a more general kind of class war against general working class and the poor. We call it the middle class, but that means working class. And these are deep problems of the society, pathologies, in fact, which show up in a clustering of murders of black men by white police. But you got to look much deeper to see where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm. And if we had 2 hours to talk, which I would love to someday, I would ask you now about the prison industrial complex as the new plantation system, and also about the attack on education. And I think that part of it is because the ruling class understands that that educated people are not going to stand for such things and for many other things like the TPP that we just discussed in the first half hour. It connects to another thing I wanted to discuss with you today, and that is the ongoing effects of American policy in the Middle East. I have been maintaining that if not for Bush's attack on Iraq and Afghanistan, we wouldn't have ISIS now, or definitely not as strong as it is. I think that Syria, to some degrees, also the horrible disaster there is also to some degree a result of American and Western policies. Yemen, the ascent of Saudi Arabia and it joining the trouble in the Middle East, and in a big way the immigrant crisis, all these people trying to escape the conflict areas in the Middle East and in Africa and dying in the thousands in the Mediterranean. Talk about that, if you will, please.
Yeah, that's a lot to talk about.
Yes, yes, I'm afraid that might take the rest of the hour.
Well, let's begin with ISIS, which is a hideous monstrosity. Where did it come from? Well, there's no real doubt among specialists. It's one of the horrifying effects of the worst crime of this millennium, the U.S.-UK invasion of Iraq. Iraq had already been virtually devastated by sanctions, 1990s sanctions, which were so severe that the respected international diplomats who administered the so-called humanitarian aspect of them, the Oil for Food program, Dennis Halliday, Hans von Sponeck, both resigned in protest, claiming that the sanctions were genocidal, and giving plenty of evidence, which the U.S. would kind of prevented them from presenting to the Security Council. It's available in a very good book by Hans von Sponeck, Another Kind of War, which I think has probably never barely been mentioned in the United States. That's the 90s. Their conclusion, and they know more about Iraq than any Westerners, was that the sanctions were devastating the civilian society, strengthening the dictator, compelling the civilian world to huddle under the umbrella of dictatorial power just for survival, and very possibly saving Saddam from the fate of a long series of other U.S.-backed monsters who'd been overthrown from within. It's a very likely effect of the 90s sanctions. They were bad enough. Then comes the sledgehammer, the invasion, which smashed Iraq, what was left of it, killed hundreds of thousands of people, generated millions of refugees and displaced persons, destroyed a lot of the society, but crucially instigated a sectarian conflict, which hadn't existed before. You know, there were tensions, but no conflict. The Shia and Sunni populations were pretty much integrated, and even at the early years of the invasion, they said, we'll never have a struggle because we're too closely integrated. Well, the regime, the brutality of and the policies of the regime, which insisted on sectarian divisions and the atrocities and the the Abu Ghraib, all the horrors that came along, Fallujah, horrifying atrocities, all of these things generated a conflict that had not ex- existed, the Shia-Sunni conflict, and that is now tearing the country apart, and indeed the region spread everywhere, including Syria. And another element of this is, as you mentioned, Saudi Arabia, a U.S. major ally in the Arab Muslim world, the most extreme radical fundamentalist state, makes Iran look liberal by comparison. Britain supported radical Islam before us. The U.S. has largely tended to support radical Islam in opposition to secular nationalism, including Saudi Arabia. But it's not only an extremist version of Islam, a very extremist fundamentalist version, but it's also, of course, a very rich society, as are the Emirates, because of the oil wealth, and it's a missionary society. So they spread their extremist Wahhabi doctrine in all kinds of ways, building mosques, sending out imams, funding madrasas, you know, Quranic schools, all kinds of ways, and it's the combination. And they have both provided, they and their associates in the Emirates have provided both the funding and the ideological initiative that finally created this extremist version of extremist Wahhabism, namely ISIS, which has very limited roots in Islam, very shallow as analyses of careful analyses of the people have shown, Scott Adrian's work, other work, but nevertheless are appeal to a large part of dispossessed and repressed Muslim youth. And it's created an absolute horror story. It's hard to know who's more brutal at this point, the ISIS monsters or the Baghdad government, which is, for example, bombing Fallujah and Sunni Fallujah and destroying hospitals and other atrocities which barely get reported. So we've just created a monstrosity. And incidentally, the same thing happened in Libya, where the imperial triumvirate, France and England in the forefront, and Obama famously leading from behind, the three of them made a decision to violate the UN Security Council resolution that they themselves had instituted, which called for a ceasefire, negotiations, diplomacy, the no-fly zone to protect any civilians who were endangered. And it looked as if Gaddafi accepted that. And current studies indicate that the war was almost over at that point. Bad, but not horrendous. They decided to violate that and become the air force of the rebels, which led to a huge humanitarian disaster. And by now, with consequences that are by now destroying the country. One of the several reasons for the horrible tragedies at sea are that there is no Libyan state any longer to regulate and control in some fashion the flow of refugees. Of course, you look back at the further reasons for the flow of refugees, well, it comes from a long history of, European destruction of Africa, which goes way back. The refugees don't come from nowhere. Mm-hmm. So all of this kind of... Meanwhile, Egypt is facing one of the most awful periods in its history, a brutal military dictatorship supported by the United States, praised by American so-called conservatives, Wall Street Journal and so on. But pretty awful monstrosity itself. There's a war a serious war going on in the Sinai. Gaza is now, its fate is kind of beyond words to mm-hmm. describe at this point, but it's caught in a pincers between Israeli vicious brutality, which is constant, and now Egypt as well. Got a phone call the other day from a friend of mine in Gaza who lives in Rafah near the border, and you could hear the Egyptian bombing right across the border as they're destroying the city on the Egyptian side. All of this is crushing what's left of Gaza. If I can recommend one book, there's a book, there were diaries, bits and pieces of them were published here by Atif Abu Saif. It just came out in a book called The Drone Eats With Me. Just got my copy today, in fact. Mm-hmm. It's the full diaries of the kind of day-by-day description of what was going on in Gaza. There are also the regular reports of Mohammed Omer, wonderful yes. young, courageous journalist who stayed there right through and kept reporting, and other evidence. But it's an utter horror story. There's been almost no reconstruction from the latest Israeli atrocity, the Protective Edge invasion last summer, which was horrifying. If you move over to Yemen, Saudi Arabia, our primary ally, is the beneficiary of tens of billions of dollars of U.S. military aid, and it's now using it in the only way they know how to do, which is a bombing of a civilian society. They're destroying what's left of Yemen. Yemen's been torn to shreds itself. Now the Saudi-led offensive, mostly bombing, is smashing up what's left. There hasn't been a period like this in the history of the region. It's just awful beyond words. How much can be put together? And this is not the whole story by any means. I haven't talked about the Israeli occupation, which is another story in itself. Mm-hmm. All of this is extremely dark, and it's hard to think of how anything decent could emerge from these awful developments, in which we have a very substantial role. It's kind of remarkable to read the commentary on this, scholarly journals and so on, almost uniformly, even in the scholarly journals. The picture is the United States is committed to stabilization of the region, and then there's a destabilizing force, which is a big problem, namely Iran. They destabilize the region with their aggression, support of terror, and so on and so forth. And we work hard to stabilize it. Sometimes this reaches a level that is surreal. So, for example, right after just one case, right after the draft agreement on the nuclear agreement with Iran was reached, the New York Times, of course, had plenty of commentary. One was a front-page think piece by one of their major analysts, Peter Baker, who was fairly favorable, towards the agreement, said maybe the best thing possible, but he warned that you really have to be careful because you can't trust Iran. Iran is committed to it's a destabilizing force, and he gave some illustrations. The most revealing one was he said that Iran is so criminal that there are supporting forces in Iraq which are killing Americans. Hmm. Just think what that means. We invade and destroy a country, set off sectarian conflicts, we're tearing it to shreds. That's stabilization. If somebody shoots back, that's destabilization.
Yeah.
That attitude is pervasive. I'll give you 100 examples. And it's a sign of a very sick culture here. Very sick. And a sick culture in some small country is not that dangerous for the world. But when it's in the most powerful state in human history, with plenty of capacity for violence and destruction, then it's a real threat to the world. And it's not that the world doesn't know this. Americans may not know it, but the world does. For example, about a little over a year ago, I guess by now almost a year and a half ago, there was an international poll, very prominent, run by the Gallup organization, the main polling organization. It was a poll of international opinion on various questions. And one question was, which country is the greatest threat to world peace? Mm-hmm. The United States was in the lead by a huge margin. No other country was even close. mm-hmm. way behind. And second place was Pakistan, probably inflated by the Indian vote. Americans are not aware of this for a simple reason. Press refused to publish it. Not a word, you know.
Right.
Pretty significant, actually, but not a word. What you hear here is a different story, almost uniform, from presidential candidates, high officials, press, and so on. Iran is the greatest threat to world peace. That's the story here. The story in the world is the United States is the greatest threat to world peace, but we're not supposed to know that. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons for it, including the kind that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, Noam Chomsky, we are basically at the end of the hour. Noam, in the last minute that we have, how you keep so vital and your brain so clear, and give us some advice as we age.
Frankly, there's nothing very profound. I think the facts are clear. I mean, what I've just discussed, for example, is really on the surface. You don't have to dig very deep to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, the reality is, of course, more complex than any brief description of it. That goes without saying. But still, I think these are pretty salient points that really spring out at you as soon as you break free from the domination of a very powerful system of dogma and doctrine.
Yeah.
So, for example, it is perfectly, just to take the last point I mentioned, it's easily understandable why Americans are unaware of what the world thinks of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that a poll by the Gallup organization is not exactly obscure, and the questions that were asked are very important ones. They happen to conflict radically with the party line here, and you can ask about the reasons, but the fact is evident. It just doesn't get reported. You can find out about it way at the fringes, but most people can't.